The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, continued. Cassette 3, Side 2. And instead of being given a brotherly embrace on their return, such as every other army in the world would have given them, instead of being given a chance to rest up, to visit their families, and then return to their units, they were held on suspicion, disarmed, deprived of all rights, and taken away in groups to identification points and screening centres, where officers of the special branches started interrogating them, distrusting not only their every word, but their very identity. Identification consisted of cross-questioning, confrontations, pitting the evidence of one against another. Afterward, some of those who had been encircled were restored to their former names, ranks, and responsibilities, and went off to military units. Others, fewer in number at the start, constituted the first wave of traitors of the motherland under 58-1B. But at first, until the standard penalty was finally determined, they got less than 10 years. That was how the active army was kept purge. But there was also an enormous inactive army in the Far East and in Mongolia, and it was the noble task of the special branches to keep that army from growing rusty. And, for lack of anything to do, the heroes of Khalkhin Gol and Khazan began to let their tongues wag, especially after they were permitted to examine the DegTRF automatic pistols and the regimental mortars, which until then had been kept secret even from Soviet soldiers. With such weapons in their hands, it was hard for them to understand why we were retreating in the West. With all Siberia and the Urals between them and European Russia, it was not easy for them to grasp that in retreating 70 miles a day, we were simply repeating the Kutuzov entrapment maneuver. Their comprehension could be helped along only by means of a wave from the Eastern Army, and at that point lips tightened and faith became steely. It was obvious that a wave had also to roll in high places, of those to blame for the retreat. After all, it was not the great strategist who was at fault. It was a small wave, just 50 men, a general's wave. They were in Moscow prisons by the summer of 1941, and in October 1941 they were sent off on a prisoner transport. Most of the generals were from the Air Force. Among them were Air Force Commander Smushkevich and General Ptukhin, who is known to have said, "If I had known, I would have first bombed our dear father and then gone off to prison." And there were others. The victory outside Moscow gave rise to a new wave, guilty Muscovites. Looking at things after the event, it turned out that these Muscovites, who had not run away and who had not been evacuated, but had fearlessly remained in the threatened capital, which had been abandoned by the authorities, were by that very token under suspicion either of subverting governmental authority, 58-10, or of staying on to await the Germans, 58-1A via 19, a wave which kept on providing fodder for the interrogators of Moscow and Leningrad right up to 1945. It need hardly be said that 58-10, ASA, anti-Soviet agitation, never let up but hovered over the front and in the rear throughout the war. Sentences under 58-10 were handed out to evacuees who talked about the horrors of the retreat. It was clear from the newspapers that the retreat was proceeding according to plan. To those in the rear who were guilty of the slanderous rumour that rations were meagre, to those at the front who were guilty of the slanderous rumour that the Germans had excellent equipment, and to those everywhere who in 1942 were guilty of the slanderous rumour that people were dying of starvation in blockaded Leningrad. During that same year, after the disasters at Kerch, 120,000 prisoners, at Kharkov, even more, and in the course of the big southern retreat to the Caucasus and the Volga, another very important wave of officers and soldiers was pumped through, those who refused to stand the death, and who retreated without permission, the men whom, in the words of Stalin's immortal order number 227, the motherland could not forgive for the shame they had caused her. This wave, however, never reached Gulag, After accelerated processing by divisional tribunals, it was, to a man, herded into punishment battalions and was soaked up in the red sand of advanced positions, leaving not a trace. Thus was cemented the foundation of the Stalingrad victory, but it has found no place in the usual Russian history and exists only in the private history of the sewage system. Incidentally, we are here trying to identify only those waves which came into Gulag from outside. There was, after all, an incessant internal recirculation from reservoir to reservoir through the system of so-called sentencing in camp, which was particularly rampant during the war years. But we are not considering those in this chapter. Conscientiousness requires that we recall also the reverse waves of wartime, the previously mentioned Czechs and Poles who were released, as well as criminals released for service at the front. From 1943 on, when the war turned in our favour, there began the multi-million wave from the occupied territories and from Europe, which got larger every year up to 1946. Its two main divisions were civilians who had lived under the Germans or among Germans, hung with a tenor under the letter A, 58-1A, military personnel who had been POWs, who were nailed with a tenor under the letter B, 58-1B. Everyone living under the occupation wanted, of course, to survive, and therefore could not remain with hands folded, and thereby theoretically earned, along with his daily bread, a future sentence, if not for treason to the motherland, then at least for aiding and abetting the enemy. However, in actual practice, it was enough to note in the passport serial number that a person had been in occupied territory. To arrest all such persons would have been, from the economic point of view, irrational, because it would have depopulated such enormous areas. All that was required in order to heighten the general consciousness was to arrest a certain percentage of those guilty, those half-guilty, those quarter-guilty, and those who had hung out their footcloths to dry on the same branch as the Germans. After all, even 1% of just 1 million fills up a dozen full-blooded camps. And dismiss the thought that honourable participation in an underground anti-German organisation would surely protect one from being arrested in this wave. More than one case proved this. For instance, there was the Kiev Komsomol member whom the underground organisation sent to serve in the Kiev police during the German occupation in order to obtain inside information. The boy kept the Komsomol honestly informed about everything, but when our forces arrived on the scene, he got his tenor because he couldn't, while serving in the police, fail to acquire some of the enemy's spirit or to carry out some enemy orders. Those who were in Europe got the stiffest punishments of all, even though they went there as conscripted German slaves. That was because they had seen something of European life and could talk about it. And their stories, which made unpleasant listening for us, except, of course, for the travel notes of sensible writers, were especially unpleasant during the post-war years of ruin and disorganization. Not everyone, after all, was able to report that things in Europe were hopelessly bad and that it was absolutely impossible to live there. That also was the reason why they sentenced the majority of war prisoners. It was not simply because they had allowed themselves to be captured, particularly those POWs who had seen a little more of the West than a German death camp. That was not such a clear-cut decision at the start. Even in 1943, there were certain separate waves which were like no others, like the so-called Africans, who bore this nickname for a long time at the Vorkuta construction projects. These were Russian war prisoners of the Germans, who had been taken prisoner a second time when the Americans captured them from Rommel's army in Africa, the Hiwi. In 1943, they were sent in Studebakers through Egypt, Iraq, and Iran to their motherland. And on a desert gulf of the Caspian, they were immediately put behind barbed wire. The police who received them ripped off their military insignia and liberated them of all things the Americans had given them, keeping them for themselves, of course, not turning them over to the state. Then they sent them off to Vorkuta to await special orders without, due to inexperience, sentencing them to a specific term under any article of the code. These Africans lived in Vorkuta in a betwixt and between condition. They were not under guard, but they were given no passes, and without passes they could not take so much as one step in Vorkuta. They were paid wages at the same rate as free workers, but they were treated like prisoners. And the special orders never did come. They were forgotten men. This was obvious from the fact that interned persons were sentenced as severely as POWs. For example, during the first days of the war, one of our destroyers went aground on Swedish territory. Its crew proceeded to live freely in Sweden during all the rest of the war, and in such comfort and plenty as they had never experienced before and would never experience again. The USSR retreated, attacked, starved, and died, while those scoundrels stuffed their neutral mugs. After the war, Sweden returned them to us along with the destroyer. Their treason to the motherland was indubitable, but somehow the case didn't get off the ground. They let them go their different ways and then pasted them with anti-Soviet agitation for their lovely stories in praise of freedom and good eating in capitalist Sweden. This was the Kadenko group. What happened to this group later makes an anecdote. In camp they kept their mouths shut about Sweden, fearing they'd get a second term. But people in Sweden somehow found out about their fate and published slanderous reports in the press. By that time, the boys were scattered far and near among various camps. Suddenly, on the strength of special orders, they were all yanked out and taken to the Kresty prison in Leningrad. There they were fed for 2 months, as though for slaughter, and allowed to let their hair grow. Then they were dressed with modest elegance, rehearsed on what to say and to whom, and warned that any bastard who dared to squeak out a turn would get a bullet in his skull. And they were led off to a press conference for selected foreign journalists and some others who had known the entire crew in Sweden. The former internees bore themselves cheerfully, described where they were living, studying, and working, and expressed their indignation at the bourgeois slander they had read about not long before in the Western press. After all, Western papers are sold in the Soviet Union at every corner newsstand. And so they had written to one another and decided to gather in Leningrad. Their travel expenses didn't bother them in the least. Their fresh, shiny appearance completely gave the lie to the newspaper canard. The discredited journalists went off to write their apologies. It was wholly inconceivable to the Western imagination that there could be any other explanation. And the men who had been the subjects of the interview were taken off to a bath, had their hair cut off again, were dressed in their former rags, and sent back to the same camps. But because they had conducted themselves properly, none of them was given a second term. Within the overall wave of those from formerly occupied areas, there followed, one after another, the quick and compact waves of the nationalities which had transgressed. In 1943, the Kalmyks, Chechens, Ingush, and Balkars. In 1944, the Crimean Tatars. They would not have been pushed out into eternal exile so energetically and swiftly had it not been that regular army units and military trucks were assigned to help the organs. The military units gallantly surrounded the owls, or settlements, and within 24 hours, with the speed of a parachute attack, those who had nested there for centuries past found themselves removed to railroad stations, loaded by the trainload, and rushed off to Siberia, Kazakhstan, Central Asia, and the Russian North. Within 1 day, their land and their property had been turned over to their heirs. What had happened to the Germans at the beginning of the war now happened to these nationalities. They were exiled solely on the basis of blood. There was no filling out of questionnaires. Party members, heroes of labor, and heroes of the still unfinished war were all sent along with the rest. During the last years of the war, of course, there was a wave of German war criminals who were selected from the POW camps and transferred by court verdict to the jurisdiction of Gulag. In 1945, even though the war with Japan didn't last 3 weeks, great numbers of Japanese war prisoners were raked in for urgent construction projects in Siberia and Central Asia, and the same process of selecting war criminals for Gulag was carried out among them. Without knowing the details, I am nevertheless convinced that a great many of these Japanese could not have been sentenced legitimately It was an act of revenge, as well as a means of holding on to manpower for as long a period as possible. At the end of 1944, when our army entered the Balkans, and especially in 1945, when it reached into Central Europe, a wave of Russian émigrés flowed through the channels of Gulag. Most were old men who had left at the time of the revolution, but there were also young people who had grown up outside Russia. They usually dragged off the menfolk and left the women and children where they were. It is true that they did not take everyone, but they took all those who, in the course of 25 years, had expressed even the mildest political views, or who had expressed them earlier during the revolution. They did not touch those who had lived a purely vegetable existence. The main waves came from Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia. There were fewer from Austria and Germany. In the other countries of Eastern Europe, there were hardly any Russians. As if in response to 1945, a wave of émigrés poured from Manchuria, too. Some of them were not arrested immediately. Entire families were encouraged to return to the homeland as free persons, but once back in Russia, they were separated and sent into exile or taken to prison. All during 1945 and 1946, a big wave of genuine, at long last, enemies of the Soviet government flowed into the archipelago. These were the Vlasov men, the Krasnov Cossacks, and Muslims from the national units created under Hitler. Some of them had acted out of conviction, others had been merely involuntary participants. Along with them were seized not less than 1 million fugitives from the Soviet government, civilians of all ages and of both sexes, who had been fortunate enough to find shelter on Allied territory, but who in 1946 to 1947 were perfidiously returned by Allied authorities into Soviet hands. It is surprising that in the West, where political secrets cannot be kept long, since they inevitably come out in print or are disclosed, the secret of this particular act of betrayal has been very well and carefully kept by the British and American governments. This is truly the last secret, or one of the last, of the Second World War. Having often encountered these people in camps, I was unable to believe for a whole quarter century that the public in the West knew nothing of this action of the Western governments, this massive handing over of ordinary Russian people to retribution and death. Not until 1973, in the Sunday Oklahoman of January the 21st, was an article by Julius Epstein published. And I am here going to be so bold as to express gratitude on behalf of the mass of those who perished and those few left alive. One random little document was published from the many volumes of the hitherto concealed case history of forced repatriation to the Soviet Union. After having remained unmolested in British hands for 2 years, they had allowed themselves to be lulled into a false sense of security, and they were therefore taken completely by surprise. They did not realize they were being repatriated. They were mainly simple peasants with bitter personal grievances against the Bolsheviks. The English authorities gave them the treatment reserved in the case of every other nation for war criminals alone, that of being handed over against their will to captors who, incidentally, were not expected to give them a fair trial. They were all sent to destruction on the archipelago. Author's note, dated 1973. A certain number of Poles, members of the Home Army, followers of Mikołajczyk, arrived in Gulag in 1945 via our prisons. There were a certain number of Romanians and Hungarians. At war's end, and for many years after, there flowed uninterruptedly an abundant wave of Ukrainian nationalists, the Banderovtsi. Against the background of this enormous post-war displacement of millions, few paid much attention to such small waves as foreigners' girlfriends in 1946 to 1947. In other words, Soviet girls who went out with foreigners. They sentenced these girls under Article 735 SOE, socially dangerous element. Spanish children, the same children who had been taken from their homeland during the Spanish Civil War, but who were adults by the end of World War II. Raised in our boarding schools, they nonetheless fitted very poorly into our life. Many longed to go home. They too were given 735 SOE, socially dangerous element. And those who were particularly stubborn got 58-6, espionage on behalf of America. In fairness, we must not forget the brief reverse wave of priests in 1947. Yes, a miracle. For the first time in 30 years, they freed priests. They didn't actually go about seeking them out in camps. But whenever a priest was known to people in freedom, and whenever a name and exact location could be provided, the individual priests in question were sent out to freedom in order to strengthen the church, which at that time was being revived. We have to remind our readers once again that this chapter does not attempt by any means to list all the waves which fertilized Gulag, but only those which had a political coloration. And just as, in a course in physiology, after a detailed description of the circulation of the blood, one can begin over again and describe in detail a lymphatic system, one could begin again and describe the waves of non-political offenders and habitual criminals from 1918 to 1953. And this description, too, would run long. It would bring to light many famous decrees, now in part forgotten, even though they have never been repealed, which supplied abundant human material for the insatiable archipelago. One was the decree on absenteeism. One was the decree on production of bad quality goods. Another was on samogon, moonshine, distilling. Its peak period was 1922, but arrests for this were constant throughout the 20s. And the decree on the punishment of collective farmers for failure to fulfill the obligatory norm of labor days. And the decree on the introduction of military discipline on railroads, issued in April 1943, not at the beginning of the war, but when it had already taken a turn for the better. In accordance with the ancient Petrine tradition, these decrees always put in an appearance as the most important element in all our legislation, but without any comprehension of or reference to the whole of our previous legislation. Learned jurists were supposed to coordinate the branches of the law, but they were not particularly energetic at it, nor particularly successful either. This steady pulse of decrees led to a curious national pattern of violations and crimes. One could easily recognize that neither burglary, nor murder, nor samogon distilling, nor rape ever seemed to occur at random intervals or in random places throughout the country as a result of human weakness, lust, or failure to control one's passions. By no means. One detected instead a surprising unanimity and monotony in the crimes committed. The entire Soviet Union would be in a turmoil of rape alone, or murder alone, or samogon distilling alone, each in its turn, in sensitive reaction to the latest government decree. Each particular crime or violation seemed somehow to be playing into the hands of the latest decree, so that it would disappear from the scene that much faster. At that precise moment, the particular crime which had just been foreseen, and for which wise new legislation had just provided stricter punishment, would explode simultaneously everywhere. The decree on the militarization of railroads crowded the military tribunals with the women and adolescents who did most of the work on the railroads during the war years, and who, having received no barracks training beforehand, were those mostly involved in delays and violations. The decree on failure to fulfill the obligatory norm of labor days greatly simplified the procedure for removing from the scene those collective farmers who were dissatisfied with receiving for their labor mere labor day points in the farm account books and wanted produce instead. Whereas previously their cases had required a trial, based on the article of the code relating to economic counter-revolution, now it was enough to produce a collective farm decree confirmed by the district executive committee. And even then, these collective farmers, although they were sent into exile, must have been relieved to know that they were not listed as enemies of the people. The obligatory norm of labor days was different in different areas, the easiest of all being among the peoples of the Caucasus, 75 labor days a year. But despite that, many of them were also sent off to Krasnoyarsk province for 8 years. As we have said, we are not going to go into a lengthy and lavish examination of the waves of non-political offenders and common criminals. But having reached 1947, we cannot remain silent about one of the most grandiose of Stalin's decrees. We have already mentioned the famous law of 7/8, or 7/8, on the basis of which they arrested people right and left for taking a stalk of grain, a cucumber, two small potatoes, a chip of wood, a spool of thread, all of whom got 10 years. In the actual documents of the spool of thread case, they wrote down 200 meters of sewing material. The fact remains that they were ashamed to write a spool of thread. But the requirements of the times, as Stalin understood them, had changed, and the tenor, which had seemed adequate on the eve of a terrible war, seemed now, in the wake of a worldwide historical victory, inadequate. And so again, in complete disregard of the code, and totally overlooking the fact that many different articles and decrees on the subject of thefts and robberies already existed, on June the 4th, 1947, a decree was issued which outdid them all. It was instantly christened 4/6 by the undismayed prisoners. The advantages of the new decree lay first of all in its newness. From the very moment it appeared, a torrent of the crimes it specified would be bound to burst forth, thereby providing an abundant wave of newly sentenced prisoners. But it offered an even greater advantage in prison terms. If a young girl sent into the fields to get a few ears of grain took along two friends for company, an organized gang, or some 12-year-old youngsters went after cucumbers or apples, they were liable to get 20 years in camp. In factories, the maximum sentence was raised to 25 years. This sentence, called the quarter, had been introduced a few days earlier to replace the death penalty, which had been abolished as a humane act. And the death penalty itself was kept veiled for a brief period only. The veil was removed, amid a show of bared fangs, 2.5 years later, in January 1950. And then, at long last, an ancient shortcoming of the law was corrected. Previously, the only failure to make a denunciation which qualified as a crime against the state had been in connection with political offences. But now, simple failure to report the theft of state or collective farm property earned 3 years of camp or 7 years of exile. In the years immediately following this decree, whole divisions from the countryside and the cities were sent off to cultivate the islands of Gulag in place of the natives who had died off there. True, these waves were processed through the police and the ordinary courts and did not clog the channels of state security, which, even without them, were overstrained in the post-war years. Stalin's new line, suggesting that it was necessary, in the wake of the victory over fascism, to jail more people more energetically and for longer terms than ever before, had immediate repercussions, of course, on political prisoners. The year 1948-1949, notable throughout Soviet public life for intensified persecution and vigilance, was marked by one tragicomedy hitherto unheard of even in Stalinist anti-justice, that of the repeaters. That is what, in the language of Gulag, they called those still undestroyed unfortunates of 1937 vintage, who had succeeded in surviving 10 impossible, unendurable years, and who in 1947 to 1948 had timidly stepped forth onto the land of freedom. Worn out, broken in health, but hoping to live out in peace what little of their lives remained. But some sort of savage fantasy, or stubborn malice, or unsated vengeance, pushed the victorious Generalissimo into issuing the new order to arrest all those cripples over again, without any new charges. It was even disadvantageous, both economically and politically, to clog the meat grinder with its own refuse. But Stalin issued the order anyway. Here was a case in which a historical personality simply behaved capriciously toward historical necessity. And so it was necessary to take all of them, though they had hardly had a chance to attach themselves to new places or new families. They were rounded up with much the same weary indolence they themselves now returned with. They knew beforehand the whole way of the cross ahead. They did not ask, what for? And they did not say to their families, I'll be back. They put on their shabbiest rags, poured some makorka into their camp tobacco pouches, and went off to sign the deposition. Only one question. Are you the one who was in prison? Yes. Take 10 more. At this point, the autocrat decided it wasn't enough to arrest just those who had survived since 1937. What about the children of his sworn enemies? They, too, must be imprisoned. They were growing up, and they might have notions of vengeance. He may have had a heavy dinner and had a nightmare about those children. They went through the lists, looked around, and arrested children, but not very many. They arrested the children of the purged army commanders, but not all the children of Trotskyites. And so the wave of the vengeful children came into being. Among such children were 17-year-old Lena Kozarieva and 35-year-old Yelena Ravokskaya. By 1948, after the great European displacement, Stalin had succeeded once again in tightly barricading himself in and pulling the ceiling down closer to him. In this reduced space, he had recreated the tension of 1937. And so, in 1948, 1949, and 1950, there flowed past alleged spies. 10 years earlier, they had been German and Japanese. Now they were Anglo-American. Believers, this wave non-orthodox for the most part. Those geneticists and plant breeders, disciples of the late Vavilov and of Mendel, who had not previously been arrested. Just plain, ordinary thinking people, and students with particular severity, who had not been sufficiently scared away from the West. It was fashionable to charge them with VAT, praise of American technology, VAD, praise of American democracy, and PZ, toadyism toward the West. These waves were not unlike those of 1937, but the sentences were different. The standard sentence was no longer the patriarchal 10-ruble bill, but the new Stalinist 25. By now, the tenor was for juveniles. There was a good-sized wave from the new decree on revealing state secrets. State secrets included such things as the district harvest, any figure on epidemics, the type of goods produced by any workshop or mini-factory, mention of a civil airport, municipal transport routes, or the family name of any prisoner imprisoned in any camp. For violations of this decree, they gave 15 years. The waves of nationalities were not forgotten either. The Ukrainian nationalists, the Banderovtsy, taken in the heat of struggle from the forests where they fought, kept flowing all this time. Simultaneously, all West Ukrainian country people received tenors and fivers in camps and exile, presumably for having had connections with the partisans. Someone had let them spend the night. Someone had once fed them. Someone had not reported them. For about a year, starting in 1950, a wave of wives of Banderovtsy was underway. They gave them each 10 years for failure to make a denunciation, so as to finish off their husbands faster. By this time, resistance in Lithuania and Estonia had already come to an end. But in 1949, new waves of new social prophylaxis to assure collectivization kept coming. They took whole trainloads of city dwellers and peasants from the three Baltic republics into Siberian exile. The historical rhythm was disrupted in these republics. They were forced to recapitulate in brief, limited periods the more extended experience of the rest of the country. In 1948, one more nationalist wave went into exile, that of the Greeks who inhabited the areas around the Sea of Azov, the Kuban, and Tsukumi. They had done nothing to offend the father during the war, but now he avenged himself on them for his failure in Greece, or so it seemed. This wave, too, was evidently the fruit of his personal insanity. The majority of the Greeks ended up in Central Asian exile. Those who voiced their discontent were thrown into political prisons. Around 1950, to avenge the same lost war, or perhaps just to balance those already in exile, the Greek rebels from Marcos's army, who had been turned over to us by Bulgaria, were themselves shipped off to the archipelago. During the last years of Stalin's life, a wave of Jews became noticeable. From 1950 on, they were hauled in, little by little, as cosmopolites. And that was why the doctor's case was cooked up. It would appear that Stalin intended to arrange a great massacre of the Jews. It has always been impossible to learn the truth about anything in our country, now and always and from the beginning. But according to Moscow rumors, Stalin's plan was this. At the beginning of March, the doctor murderers were to be hanged on Red Square. The aroused patriots, spurred on naturally by instructors, were to rush into an anti-Jewish pogrom. At this point, the government, and here Stalin's character can be divined, can it not, would intervene generously to save the Jews from the wrath of the people, and that same night would remove them from Moscow to the Far East in Siberia, where barracks had already been prepared for them. But this became the first plan of his life to fail. God told him, apparently with the help of human hands, to depart from his rib cage. The preceding exposition should have made it clear, one would think, that in the removal of millions and in the populating of Gulag, consistent, cold-blooded planning and never-weakening persistence were at work. That we never did have any empty prisons, merely prisons which were full or prisons which were very, very overcrowded. And that while you occupied yourself to your heart's content studying the safe secrets of the atomic nucleus, researching the influence of Heidegger on Sartre, or collecting Picasso reproductions, while you rode off in your railroad sleeping compartment to vacation resorts, or finished building your country house near Moscow, the black Mariahs rolled incessantly through the streets, and the Gabisti, the state security men, knocked at doors and rang doorbells. And I think this exposition proves that the organs always earned their pay. Chapter 3. The Interrogation. If the intellectuals and the players of Chekhov, who spent all their time guessing what would happen in 20, 30, or 40 years, had been told that in 40 years interrogation by torture would be practiced in Russia, that prisoners would have their skulls squeezed within iron rings, that a human being would be lowered into an acid bath, that they would be trussed up naked to be bitten by ants and bedbugs, that a ramrod heated over a primer stove would be thrust up their anal canal, the secret brand, that a man's genitals would be slowly crushed beneath the toe of a jackboot, and that, in the luckiest possible circumstances, prisoners would be tortured by being kept from sleeping for a week, by thirst, and by being beaten to a bloody pulp. Not one of Chekhov's plays would have gotten to its end, because all the heroes would have gone off to insane asylums. Yes, not only Chekhov's heroes, but what normal Russian at the beginning of the century, including any member of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, could have believed would have tolerated such a slander against the bright future. What had been acceptable under Tsar Alexei Mikhailovich in the 17th century, what had already been regarded as barbarism under Peter the Great, what might have been used against 10 or 20 people in all during the time of Biron in the mid-18th century, what had already become totally impossible under Catherine the Great, was all being practiced during the flowering of the glorious 20th century in a society based on socialist principles and at a time when airplanes were flying and the radio and talking films had already appeared, not by one scoundrel alone in one secret place only, but by tens of thousands of specially trained human beasts standing over millions of defenseless victims. Was it only that explosion of atavism which is now evasively called the cult of personality that was so horrible? Or was it even more horrible that during those same years, in 1937 itself, we celebrated Pushkin's centennial, and that we shamelessly continued to stage those self-same Chekhov plays, even though the answers to them had already come in? Is it not still more dreadful that we are now being told, 30 years later, don't talk about it? If we start to recall the sufferings of millions, we are told it will distort the historical perspective. If we doggedly seek out the essence of our morality, we are told it will darken our material progress. Let's think rather about the blast furnaces, the rolling mills that were built, the canals that were dug. No, better not talk about the canals. Then maybe about the gold of the Kolyma. No, maybe we ought not to talk about that either. Well, we can talk about anything, so long as we do it adroitly, so long as we glorify it. It is really hard to see why we condemn the Inquisition. Wasn't it true that beside the autos da fe, magnificent services were offered the Almighty? It is hard to see why we are so down on serfdom. After all, no one forbade the peasants to work every day. And they could sing carols at Christmas, too. And for Trinity Day, the girls wove wreaths. The exceptional character which written and oral legend nowadays assigns to the year 1937 is seen in the creation of fabricated charges and tortures. But this is untrue, wrong. Throughout the years and decades, interrogations under Article 58 were almost never undertaken to elicit the truth, but were simply an exercise in an inevitably filthy procedure. Someone who had been free only a little while before, who was sometimes proud and always unprepared, was to be bent and pushed through a narrow pipe, where his sides would be torn by iron hooks, and where he could not breathe, so that he would finally pray to get to the other end. And at the other end he would be shoved out, an already processed native of the archipelago, already in the promised land. The fool would keep on resisting. He even thought there was a way back out of the pipe. The more time that passes without anything being written about all this, the harder it becomes to assemble the scattered testimony of the survivors. But they tell us that the creation of fabricated cases began back in the early years of the Organs, so their constant salutary activity might be perceived as essential. Otherwise, what with the decline in the number of enemies, the Organs might, in a bad hour, have been forced to wither away. As the case of Kosirev makes clear, the situation of the Cheka was shaky even at the beginning of 1919. Reading the newspapers of 1918, I ran into the official report of a terrible plot that had just been discovered. A group of 10 people wanted to, it seems they only wanted to, drag cannon onto the roof of an orphanage, let's see how high was it, and shell the Kremlin. There were 10 of them, including perhaps women and youngsters. And it was not reported how many cannon there were to be, nor where the cannon were to come from, nor what caliber they were, nor how they were to be carried up the stairs to the attic, nor how they were to be set up on the steeply sloping roof, and so they wouldn't recoil when fired. How was it that the Petersburg police, when they were fighting to put down the February Revolution, took nothing heavier than a machine gun up to the roofs? Yet this fantasy, exceeding even the fabrications of 1937, was read and believed. Apparently it will prove to us in time that the Gumilev case of 1921 was also fabricated. A.A. Akhmatova told me she was convinced that this was so. She even gave me the name of the Czechist who cooked up the case. Y. Agranov, it seems. In that same year, 1921, the Ryazan Cheka fabricated a false case of a plot on the part of the local intelligentsia. But the protests of courageous people could still reach Moscow, and they dropped the case. That year, too, the whole Saprepolite Committee, part of the Commission on the Use of Natural Forces, was shot. Familiar enough with the attitude and the mood of Russian scientists at that time, and not being shut off from those years by a smokescreen of fanaticism, we can indeed figure out, even without archaeological excavations, the precise validity of that case. Here is what Y. Doyarenko remembers about 1921. The Lubyanka